This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The thing which really changes him and gives him a totally new direction, which really was not foreseen in the earlier period, is France goes to war in 1792, goes to war with the rest of Europe, with first Austria-Hungary, then England, everyone else just about, 1792-93. And the war goes badly, for all sorts of reasons. France is in a mess. The army is in an absolute mess. Most of the officer corps have actually emigrated. They're nobles. They don't want to have anything to do with the revolution. They emigrate to Germany.
Hi, everyone. This is AJ Woodhams, host of the War Books Podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I'm extremely excited to have on the show Colin Jones for his new book, The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris. Colin is Emeritus Professor of Cultural History at Queen Mary University of London and Visiting Professor at the University of Chicago. He has published widely on French history, particularly the 18th century, the French Revolution, and the history of medicine. His many books include The Great Nation, France from Louis the 15th to Napoleon, Paris, Biography of a City, Versailles, and The Fall of Robespierre, which we are talking about today. He is a fellow of the British Academy and past president of the Royal Historical Society. Colin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yes, I'm interested to hear what the questions you have to ask me about the book.
Absolutely. Well, very excited to have you on. So we're recording in 2023, but this will actually be the first episode of 2024 that comes out in January. Now, if we were talking the revolutionary calendar, well, it's not January. What month is January on the revolutionary calendar?
Well, the months actually start because the calendar itself was set up in 1793, but it was set up so that it was made to originate on the day that the French National Assembly declared itself France to be a republic. And that was the 21st of September 1792. The king had been overthrown, King Louis the 16th had been overthrown in August. And so the months actually started on the 21st. So the calendar that they introduced gave a sort of meteorological climatic feel to each of the months. And so the middle of, December.
It's like seasons.
Which attaches to the word neige, which is snow. So it's the sort of snowy month.
Okay.
And on the other extreme, the middle of summer, which is the day on which Robespierre was overthrown, was the 9th of Thermidor, and Thermidor obviously is the hot month. It's the hottest month of the year. So it has been pointed out that this allegedly universal new calendar for the humanity only really operated properly in the Northern Hemisphere, because of course all those weather details would be wrong for the Southern. But this is the way the revolutionaries tried to think about the revolution that they were undertaking. They saw it really as a epochal event in the history of humanity.
Yeah, well, we'll dive into that. What did you say the month for January was? You said it's
Nivose. N-I-V-O-S-A.
All right, so this is going to be coming out in Nivose. Before we actually start talking about your book, I have to ask you, because I have a historian, a French history on the show right now, talking about the revolutionary era. Did you see the Napoleon movie?
I haven't yet. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And a very good friend of mine, who's a very distinguished historian of the French Revolution, he said to me, "C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas l'histoire." In other words, it's magnificent, but it is not history. So I think I'm going to be. I am always a bit of a skeptic about historical films, and I think it's a sort of professional deformation that you can't watch a history film without sort of seeing things that are anachronistic or you think are wrong or whatever. But I have heard very positive things about it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, as far as like being like an action filled movie, I thought it was very, very, very interesting. Not to spoil too much for you, but the scene where Robespierre shoots himself is dramatized in the movie. So if any viewers or listeners out there have seen the movie, that's what we're talking about here today. Well, let's start off then talking about your book. One of the questions that I like authors to answer first when they come on my show is, if in your own words, can you tell me, what is your book about?
Yes, well, it's about a day, and it's a very particular way of writing the history of the day, that we'll talk about it. But it was a key day, a crucial day in the history of the revolution. And so often historians write about the revolution in terms of these really major turning points. And there's like three or four of them, really, which usually are the pivots around which the story is told. And the first of those is obviously the 14th of July, 1789. It's still commemorated as the French National Day. And that was the day that the Bastille was overthrown, and the monarchy accepted that it had to have a constitution and there would be a constitutional monarchy. The next day is the 10th of August, 1792, and that is the day on which the monarchy was overthrown. So everything changed as a result of that. And then the final one, if I skip over my one, if you like, would be the 18th of Brumaire in year 8, which is in fact 1799. And that's the day in which Napoleon performed his famous coup d'etat, threw out the directory form of government and instituted the consulate, which then became the empire and all the rest of it. But of those three dates, the fourth, just as important, in some ways equally important, definitely equally important, is the 9th of Thermidor year 2, which is the 27th of July, 1794. And that was the day that Robespierre was overthrown. Robespierre was an absolutely crucial figure in the period prior to that, which is often called the Terror. And the 9th of Thermidor begins a movement away from the Terror and away from the more radical policies and extreme policies associated with the revolution in 1793 to 4. So it's one of the turning points. And therefore, you know, when I was looking around for a subject, I wanted to work on the revolution a few years ago. I had a sort of interest in doing that. I thought, well, this is a really important day. People know of it. They know certainly of all, everyone who knows anything about the revolution knows about Robespierre. So I'll work on that. And it is, and this is one of the things that attracted to me, and I'll sort of give you a brief indication of what the book is about, is that basically it's the day on which most of Paris gets together and overthrows the one of the principal figures in the revolutionary government, which was ruling France and managing the terror throughout France. And it's a very dramatic day, which I can I'll break down in any way you want in a minute. But basically, it starts with Robespierre being shouted down in the National Assembly and arrested. But then he's sent out to a prison. And while he's sent out to a prison, Paris, or the Paris municipality, the commune, the city hall, tries to organize an insurrection against the National Assembly. It's helped by the fact that Robespierre actually escapes or isn't allowed into the prison. And so you have this very dramatic evening of 27th of July, 1794, where the National Assembly, And the forces, the armed forces that it can bring together is in a face-off with the city hall, about 2 kilometers, mile and a half down the road towards the east of Paris. And the revolution and the fate of the revolution is counting absolutely on what happens from that that conflict. In the end, I mean, we all know it goes the way of the National Convention. Robespierre and his supporters in the city hall are arrested. Many of the lead Robespierre, his supporters in the National Assembly, a small group, and about 100 people within the city hall's management are executed on the following day.
Well, first, let me just say I'm impressed that, so your book is just about 24 hours and it's about 600 pages. And I'm impressed that you've been able to. Did you think? Were you wondering, am I going to have enough material to fill this up, or was there just so much going on that you're like, I could double this size?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because there aren't many days in history in which you could write a history quite like this, which was so focused. And I think it is certainly for the 18th century. And arguably more than that, it's one of the best documented days in certainly in the revolution, certainly in the 18th century, and possibly more widely than that. And that is because it was seen as an absolutely crucial day. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, it's a sort of light bulb day, like the assassination of JFK or the death of Elvis. People always think what I was doing on that particular day. Many people write memoirs. But also there was an official inquiry into what went on. And this is a bit like the Warren Commission after the Kennedy assassination, which is very, very detailed. And then also because it was such an important day in terms of what people felt and what they did on the day, whether they had supported Robespierre or not, it was many people over the next year or so would be arrested, thrown into prison and made to say what they had done and what they had been up to on that particular day. So we have this extraordinarily dense documentation at a very, very granular level. And so when I thought I'd go into the history of the day, I didn't really realize the extent to which one could get this incredibly granular material on what just private individuals who are caught up in the in the action, obviously the actors themselves, the main protagonists as well, but just normal people in the streets, in the bars, you know, in the gardens, etc., get caught up on this and give very, very precise and detailed accounts of what they did and what happened and what they saw and what they heard. And so you've got these hundreds and hundreds, literally hundreds, probably 1,000 or more, micro narratives of part of the day. Which some of them, you know, giving a lot of detail over a long period, some of them just a particular episode. And so my job as a historian of the day was to try and do justice to the density of that material and give a sense of, you know, what the revolution felt like for those who were engaged in it, you know, on this particular day. And it was a very big day in which a lot of people were involved, but also the people who witnessed it in some way as well.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the 9th of Thermidor, which is the 27th of July, 1794, I want to talk a little bit about Robespierre, the person. What kind of person was Robespierre? What was his background? What was he doing right before? I think you're right, he was just kind of an obscure lawyer right before the revolution. What's kind of his story?
Well, you know, the French historian, historian of ideas, Marcel Gauchet, recently wrote a biography of Robespierre, an intellectual biography, and he called it Robespierre, the man who divides us most. And I think that says something rather important about Robespierre. He's the sort of person, he would say in England, we have this expression, he's a Marmite candidate. Marmite is something you spread on bread. Some people absolutely love it. the rest of the population absolutely hate it. It's one of, he sort of divides people enormously. So asking what he's like, you know, it's quite difficult, but there's the two versions of it, really. But the sort of bad picture, the sort of black legend of Robespierre is that he is a proto-totalitarian dictator. He's the sort of Mussolini, Hitler, whoever, of the late 18th century, who's dictating the revolution. Everyone is frightened of, and who is running a reign of terror, who sort of sorted out the guillotine, who's just trying to destroy anyone who's getting in his way, and is trying to establish a dictatorship of virtue, because he talks a lot about republican virtue. That is a caricature which was really generated, particularly after he fell. You know, people exaggerated many of his qualities. So we need to. It's difficult to get to him without getting through the sort of incredible amount of bad propaganda, the bad press that he's had. But if one tries to do that, let me give you a few indications. One of them is that if there hadn't been a revolution, we would never have heard of Maximilien Robespierre. A few obscure historians of the 18th century, such as myself, might have heard about this minor provincial lawyer who seems to have been a bit of an intellectual and was keen to write some reforming, enlightened prose about justice and all the rest of it. He was working in a minor provincial town, the city of Arras in Picardy, and he'd been educated in Paris. But in 1789, he's elected to the Estates General, which becomes the National Assembly, essentially, as the revolution goes on, and which tries to, which really reforms and revolutionizes French government and in every way. He's elected to that. And in that assembly, he becomes known as a defender of the people. He's always supporting the popular cause. Honestly, you know, sometimes people said that, I know about Elvis Presley, they say, you know, that his death was a good career move. In fact, I think for Robespierre, if he had died in 1791 or 92, people would say, well, he was the future of the revolution. This is a great tragedy. He was a radical man. He seemed to support the good causes. He totally believed in all the freedoms of the individual, right to speak, religious freedom, no imprisonment without trial. He was even against capital punishment. He was one of the few in the assembly who spoke very passionately about the importance of abolishing capital punishment.
So interesting.
Ironic, in terms of what came next. He was the sort of thing I say to colleagues in England or friends in England. I say he was the sort of person who was a Guardian reader. All those sort of like left liberal wishy-washy sort of qualities we all believe in now. But in 1791-92, he moves out of the assembly. They have a new assembly. He then goes back into it in 1792. But the thing which really changes him and gives him a totally new direction, which really was not foreseen in the earlier period, is France goes to war in 1792. Goes to war with the rest of Europe, with first Austria-Hungary, then England, everyone else just about 1792-93. And the war goes badly. And the war goes badly for all sorts of reasons. France is in a mess. The army is in an absolute mess. Most of the officer corps have actually emigrated. They're nobles. They don't want to have anything to do with the revolution. They emigrate to Germany. They're led by the princes of the blood, the king's brothers, who start forming an army on the frontiers of France in Germany. And they cooperating with the allied armies of Austria and Prussia in particular. That is a fantastic pressure on France, and particularly as the king and the church in particular as well, which the Catholic Church, which has been reformed, but this has produced a division within the church. There's a sort of civil war going on as well in 1792-1793, and Robespierre has the perspicacity. Perhaps other people would have seen this as well and grasped this. They probably would. But his view is that the only way that France is going to survive and not be picked off by those powers and partitioned and, you know, reduced to the a shadow of its former self would be by what he says is to rally the people. So in other words, what he tries to do is to introduce social reforms, radical social reforms, which will give people the incentive to fight for the revolution, to volunteer for the army, and so on. And this is not necessarily popular throughout the political class, political elite in 1793-4. And indeed, it's only imposed as Robespierre and a group of individuals within the National Assembly develop their policies and actually exclude from the National Assembly and also within Paris as well, critics of the government. So there's a very strong authoritarian, but also socially radical set of policies which he brings in. Afterwards, they don't use this expression much at the time, actually. The people say this is the terror with a capital T. People talk about terror, which is what they're trying to do, to have a very authoritarian government where people are frightened, if you like, of opposing the government, but also they want policies that will incentivize people to fight for the revolution. And indeed, it is successful. You know, the armies of France in 1793-2 are in an absolute mess. You know, they go in retreat. France is nearly overrun on a number of occasions, 1792-93. But by giving this sort of incentive to people to join up and to fight for the revolution, they're able to put in the field a very, very large army. You know, probably we're talking about well over a million adult males at this time. 14 armies scattered on all the frontiers of France, fighting on absolutely every frontier. And indeed, they do succeed. And they also bring the civil war, particularly in the west of France, under control. And then they basically force out the Allied troops who were on French territory in 1793 and particularly 1794. And just before and I think it's an important element in the in understanding the day of 27th of July, 9th of Thermidor, in June, late June, the Battle of Fleurus on the northern frontier is a very, very successful victory, which really means France does not a threat of invasion anymore. And indeed, Belgium and indeed the Netherlands are opening themselves up to invasion. So I think those sort of background factors are very important. And Robespierre, you know, he in some ways, you know, all his career before he joins the government in 1793 has been the sort of popular supporter of the people and whistleblower against power. He's then brought into power, but he isn't, you know, as people say, he isn't really a dictator in the sort of 21st century sense. This government policy is being directed by a group of 12 men who are elected by the National Assembly, the so-called Committee of Public Safety. And he is one of 12 who's doing the stuff. You know, he's not even primus inter pares in some ways, not outstanding in any ways. He says himself, I'm 1/12 of the authority of the government. What he is, however, and this is the important part of his character, is he is the ideologist of revolutionary government. He's the man who does the big speeches in the National Assembly and the Jacobin Club. He's then diffused within France, and they give a sort of sense of what the revolution is fighting for.
And
his colleagues respect him for that. They see him as someone he's called the incorruptible, the virtuous guy who actually will get people out on the battle lines, if you like, and the barricades, if necessary, to fight for the revolution.
Now, was that true that he was incorruptible? Is there any historical evidence that he was corruptible?
We have no real evidence that he was corrupted in any particular way. Whereas a lot of the other revolutionaries, they see the material benefits of the revolution and benefit from it. I mean, famously, one of his big rivals in government in 1793-4, he helped send to the guillotine, Danton. Danton's extremely corrupt. Danton is the sort of guy who likes the revolution for all the right, you know, radical reasons, but actually doesn't mind lining his pockets along the way. Robespierre's always been the person who stands above that. And he presents himself in a way which, again, divides people. Some people think he's an incredible hypocrite, but he's very austere. He's very pure. He's very puritanical in many ways. He doesn't drink much. He doesn't eat much even. He always seems to be someone who's totally dedicated to the revolution. And indeed, and it's a sort of aspect of his character, which I think you could see as both fault and also virtue. He identifies with the revolution and identifies with the people of France in a very, very striking way. He once at one stage says, he says in French, "Je suis peuple." I am the people. I am of the people, if you like. I'm one of the people, if you like. And that type of identification, which, funnily enough, becomes a bit of a thing in French history when you think of Napoleon, you think of Charles de Gaulle, etc., etc. The sort of providential leader, if you like, but someone who has these qualities of devotion, dedication to the popular cause of the revolution, which are very, very striking.
So when would you say Robespierre was, two questions. One, when would you say Robespierre was at the height of his power? And the second question is the day right before the 7th of Thermidor. So I guess 6th of Thermidor, July 26th. If I was sitting down and let's say I was having coffee with Robespierre, what would I come away with from that conversation?
The two questions go together rather well, actually, because I would say that Robespierre was at the height of his power. He's at the most respected. He's seen as a key figure in the way in which the government is working. And he's seen as someone who's bringing the revolution success, probably about 2 or 3 months before this. In March and April, he personally sort of supervises, first of all, a purge of the government of Danton, his rival, and some of the people who are associated with him, who have been calling for a moderation of the terror. At the other extreme, he actually eradicates from political life. Many go to the guillotine. People on the sort of far left, who he sees as, again, threatening the revolution. And he thinks that he's called the war against faction. He thinks he gets rid of these factions, everything will be above board and there will be no problem. But he soon realizes, in fact, that in some ways he's made matters worse, that there's more faction and there's more resentment against him by people on both the left and right, because they feel that he's gone too far in attacking fellow revolutionaries. And then he realizes that something is going wrong. And about 6 weeks before the 9th of Thermidor, he stops going to the Committee of Public Safety, where, you know, they're running a war. It's an incredibly active set of people running this incredible war against the rest of Europe. He stops going there. He stops going to the national convention. So he just doesn't show up. He doesn't make any speeches. People are puzzled about this, obviously. But he does go to the Jacobin Club. And the Jacobin Club is a sort of political association, a political club, which is seen as the most important one in the whole of the revolution. It has a network of clubs, Jacobin clubs throughout France. But the Parisian one, obviously, is the really important one. Politicians are there, but also normal Parisians as well. So he goes to the Jacobin Club very regularly still, and he makes speeches which are very, very critical about the government, of which he formally is still part. You know, he's sort of attacking the government. He's sort of casting aspersions against his colleagues within the National Assembly. And this really, I think this is where his power is. The power which and respect which he's commanded, I think, to a very considerable extent in France up to then, is really starts frittering away because people don't know what he's after. They don't quite see where he's going. Does he want another purge? Does he want to get rid of even his colleagues? Is he actually aiming for a personal dictatorship on the lines of, well, probably people aren't thinking of obviously Hitler, they're thinking of Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar, because they're always very focused on what happened in antiquity. So this sort of puzzlement, I think, is you've got a period of puzzlement about what Robespierre is up to, which has been going on for a month or six weeks or so. If we then fast forward to, you know, the previous day is absolutely crucial in understanding what happened on the 27th, because what happens on that day, after this period of absence, Robespierre actually turns up at the convention and launches into an incredibly long speech, rambling speech, which is very, very inward-looking. It's very narcissistic. It's very bitter. It's very repeating the Robespierre themes of the importance of incorruptibility, the importance of the people, etc., etc. But it's seen as a very threatening letter to many people around the sitting around the convention hall and in in the government around the table in the offices of the Committee of Public Safety. And in fact, it is so vehement, but also so vague that many, just about anyone in political life who feels that Robespierre has looked askance at them at any time over the previous couple of, previous year or so, feels them, they're reaching for their collars, actually. They're feeling pretty uncomfortable. They're thinking that he's actually going to launch some sort of attack on them the next day. Now, we can talk a bit more about whether what he was intending to do. But the crucial thing is that his action on that day really gets together, almost for the first time, an organized opposition against him. He repeats that speech in the Jacobin Club in the evening. He actually personally attacks in his speech. One or two of his colleagues are actually present in the Jacobin Club. So people realize there's a massive collision coming at some stage in the revolution. But one of the things that's really struck me in doing the research, and again, it runs against what a lot of people have thought about the 9th of Thermidor, is really people were not anticipating it. They knew there was a crisis in government. They were very puzzled about Robespierre. But even people, his colleagues in the Committee of Public Safety are very nervous about attacking them because he is so popular. You know, they see Robespierre as, there's a recent historian, Antoine Litti in France, who's written a very fascinating book on celebrity, the emergence of the ideas of celebrity that we have today. He's like that. He's not just famous. He's a celebrity. People are, adulating him, if you like, seeing him or hating him, of course, as one does with celebrities. And his colleagues think, well, he is so popular that if we attacked him in any way, he has so much support in the convention, seemingly. He doesn't actually, but people think he does. So much in the city hall, so much in the local administration in Paris, that they would risk their own lives in that way. So people have been holding back and just hoping they can negotiate with Robespierre. And then on the 8th of Thermidor, he makes this sort of very, very wild speech in many ways. And people think, we've got to act. And overnight, there's a mobilization, if you like. First of all, some of the people who feel most threatened by Robespierre start going around to the private homes of many of the moderate deputies and saying, look, we've got to get rid of Robespierre. He's out of control. He's a loose cannon. You think he's going to hit me tomorrow, but it'll be you the next day. And there's a sort of alliance of the very, very frightened, which gets together very swiftly over that night. And within the Committee of Public Safety, even though when you look at what they actually do, it shows that they're still very, very nervous about belling the cat, putting the bell around the cat, if you like, because they're all fearful for their lives. So the 8th of Thermidor really does set up the 9th of Thermidor, but it doesn't make its outcome clear. In fact, I say this in the book, in some ways, if one were a betting man or woman on the 8th of Thermidor, or even on the morning of 9th of Thermidor, you say, well, it's going to all come down to today. Which way is it going to go? You would probably think, well, Robespierre would prevail. You would think, well, okay, he's got a lot of enemies now after yesterday, but actually he's got a lot of support in the National Convention. The mayor of Paris, the head of the city hall, is his nominee. The National Guard, very, very important, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The commander there is his personal nominee. He's got a lot of support within the convention, and he's got a lot of celebrity. So you think he's the guy who's going to prevail rather than the convention. and it happens completely differently from what one might have predicted.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the day. Let's talk about, so your book actually starts at midnight and you go hour by hour. What are, first, how does this day start for Robespierre at midnight? And then what are some of the more dramatic turns that this day takes?
Yeah. So I did make this decision after quite some time. I thought I would write a history of the day, but the decision to write it in this unusual way, where, as you say, I start at midnight and finish more or less about midnight and have a bit of a chapter or so afterwards just describing what happened next. Because I think with a lot of histories of a short period of time, there is a tendency to produce a long sort of, you know, the context, the causes, the preconditions, and then you're looking at the aftermath and the consequences. And as a result, the history of the day, first of all, gets squashed between these two things, but also it all looks predetermined because you've sort of explained what's going to happen, even though the way in which you've explained it is determined by what actually happened on the day. So my idea was that basically to give this sort of sense of indetermination, of uncertainty about the issue of what would happen in the day, I should try and put it down at the level of the people of Paris, if you like, what they were going through from midnight through to the end of the action. And so in some ways, the outcome was determined by what happened actually on the day, which was a bit uncertain. You couldn't have predicted it, really, to start with. So I give that sort of sense by going from midnight onwards. And I try and give a sort of sense of the way in which and the turning points within the day where things could have gone differently. So I start with midnight, where the Committee of Public Safety is still in session. They often work through the night. No Robespierre, but they know they're trying to work out what to happen on the next day. At the same time, you've got these deputies who feel very frightened for their lives going around trying to mobilize among the normal deputies of the assembly. But at the same time, I try and give a sense of the sleeping city. You know, the city is asleep. At Les Halles, the marketplace people start turning up from 3 a.m. or something like that. But you know, it is a city which is not anticipating a dramatic day the following day. Most of them know there's probably some stuff going on in the government, but you know, there's been stuff before. Why should the next day be very different? And that the people of Paris remain in that sort of state really until the afternoon. But what happens by the morning is that the person who has been most prominent in going around and mobilizing support within Paris, within the among the deputies, is a man called Tallien. Tallien is someone who Robespierre seems to hate for reasons which have to do with his politics, but also his private life as well. Tallien's mistress is imprisoned more or less under Robespierre's orders about a month or so before the revolution. She's probably going to go to the revolutionary tribunal. There is this story, which I tell in the book, that the previous day she writes from prison that she's been told she's going to go to the Revolutionary Tribunal. She says, I had a dream last night in which I was free and that Robespierre was overthrown. But of course, that's never going to happen because I don't have a lover who will stop it. Well, actually, she does have a lover who will stop it because he is an absolutely key figure. And he's not in touch with the government, with the Committee of Public Safety. He's got enough support, he thinks, within the convention to make a difference. And he marches into the assembly, stops the business of the affair, and attacks Robespierre, attacks his ally, Saint-Just, attacks that faction within government. And what happens is very extraordinary, actually, because at first you see people realizing, wow, something's going on here, but they don't seem to know what it is. They're sort of puzzled. But Tania has got some of his supporters from the previous night to agree that whenever he says something, they clap. So they all start clapping furiously. And then you've got this sort of contagion within the assembly where everyone realizes, yeah, Robespierre is being attacked. And actually, we have got fed up with him, and he was going too far, and he does seem to have been aiming at dictatorship. And so over that late part of the morning into the early afternoon, they basically launch an attack on Robespierre in the assembly. He's arrested. He and about four or five of his allies within the assembly, including his brother, are arrested. And they send them out about 4 o'clock in the afternoon to prisons throughout Paris. They don't want to keep them together. But they send them to separate prisons. Now, at that stage, the government and the National Assembly think, well, that's it, job done. You know, we'll go out and have dinner now. You know, we've been holding on to our stomachs for an hour or two. Let's go and have a really good meal. And they do. And the Committee of Public Safety is still turning business over. But no one realizes, really, that down the road, as I say, about a mile and a half to the east in the city hall, the news of Robespierre's arrest has come in. And the mayor, the commander of the National Guard, and a couple of other key individuals realize that they have got to stop the National Convention. And what they try and do is to mobilize support by writing out and by trying to mobilize by just going out in the streets, people to come to the city hall with the idea of a major sort of insurrectionary force to be gathered there to move through the streets of Paris on the National Convention. Now, about 7 o'clock in the evening, the National Assembly goes back into session. In fact, at first, there's very few people there because most people think it's just going to be routine business. And in fact, they're very surprised to hear what's going on. We have an account, one deputy who's actually having one, he's having his dinner over in the other side of the river in the what's now the 7th arrondissement in a fine restaurant there. And he's sort of tucking in there, and he suddenly hears someone going through the street saying, Robespierre's being arrested, everyone come to the city hall. You know, so he suddenly realized things have got out of hand. He goes back. Basically, the National Assembly starts forming in that that evening and trying to sort of find out what is going on. You know, in Paris, they realize insurrection is going on, but they just don't know what's really happening out on the streets. So you've got this very strange period going on, where the city hall is mobilizing, and for an hour or two, this convention does not know what the heck is going on. And indeed, what happens between eight and nine o'clock, one of the leaders out at the commune, out at the city hall, takes a big force of men, about 2,000 men, National Guardsmen, and they walk to the National Convention, and they want to actually, they've heard Robespierre is arrested, and they want actually to free him. Actually, Robespierre by then has been sent out, so they don't do that. But they are honestly within a hair's breadth of winning the day, because the National Assembly, the convention, is completely undefended. For reasons which historians still dispute, the commander of the National Guard says, okay, we're not going to do this. We're going to go back in an orderly way to the city hall, and we're going to sort out the proper strategy on what to do. And at that moment, well, they realize how incredibly lucky they've been. The man sitting in the chair of presiding over the assembly says to his colleagues, he says, we've got to die like Romans now. You know, we're going to be massacred. But suddenly they hear the forces going away. And they're not, they basically, what they do is they order the arrest of all these leaders within the municipality and the arrest of Robespierre. And shortly afterwards, they declare that they are outlaws. If they're outlaws, that means they don't need trial. They will just be placed under arrest and can be executed. They've got to get hold of these people. So in a way, you know, they realize they're in a bad state. And they've also realized they're in a particularly bad state, because news is coming in that far from being in prison, Robespierre has been turned away from the prison to which he's been sent. And is actually, he will be making his way gradually. We'll get there by 10 o'clock. To the city hall. So you've got this, you know, very forcible sort of situation. And it's, again, one of the key moments, and it's about 9 o'clock at night, is that in the convention, they realize that they're in this terrible, terrible situation. And they realize that the commander of the National Guard is on the other side. And they make a decision which it's completely unpredictable. No time in the revolution has there any National Assembly done this. They basically appoint one of their members, a guy called Barras, to be the commander of all the armed forces in Paris. They give him 12 adjuncts and they say, organize. And basically what he does, he and his adjuncts go out, get on their horses, essentially, and go through the streets of Paris, where already the city hall has been trying to mobilize people and say, get their narrative across. Robespierre is an outlaw. He's been conspiring against the National Assembly. He wants to be a dictator. You've got to support the rule of law. You've got to support the revolution. If you don't, everything that you fought for will be lost. And basically, overnight, you've got this extraordinary situation where normal Parisians are in the streets, or, you know, in their local sectional assembly or whatever, trying to work out what's going on, realizing they've got to make a really important decision on which the fate of the revolution might depend, and their own fate as well. Because if Robespierre wins, you know, anyone who opposed him the previous day will be up for the, with not the chop, but at least for imprisonment, and the other way as well. So what I try to do in my book is to give a sense of that sort of existential choice that people have had. It's incredibly important political choice that people have to make at that moment, one way or the other, and to understand why. And to understand why, you basically find people sticking up for the rule of law, for the National Convention, for all the revolution has done so far, for the fact that the revolution seems to be winning the war, and they reject Robespierre, who, despite everything that he's been very strong in, has puzzled people and seems to be acting in a very irrational way. And by just after midnight, actually, the forces of the convention, and we'll talk a bit about the forces maybe next, but are surrounding the city hall. They move in on the city hall. They go up to collect Robespierre in one of the rooms there for things we still don't know, actually, what happens exactly. But Robespierre is shot, possibly by himself, possibly by someone else, but he's not shot and killed. He's shot in the jaw, which means that this man who's been the ideologist, the great speaker of the French Revolutionary Assemblies, is silenced for the rest of his life. And the next day he's identified by the authorities, by the Revolutionary Tribunal. He's taken out and executed.
Yeah. Wow. Well, first, thank you for that. A couple things come to my mind. First, you're in the Napoleon movie, they took the liberty of deciding he shot himself. So that's what people will see. But second, what I think is so fascinating about this, I mean, there's so much to say about all the events that unfolded, but the people themselves, who, as you said, Robespierre is a very popular figure, super popular, and for people to turn on him personally, but to not turn on some of these other principles, I found fascinating. Why do you think most people chose to stay true to the principles of the revolution as opposed to the man Robespierre?
Well, I think the thing to bear in mind on this is that, and we haven't talked about it much, but especially for war books seminar, we should do, because this is a day which is, there's fighting but no deaths. There's hardly anyone apart from the people who actually go to the guillotine the next day. That it isn't a bloody day like 14th of July or 1789 or whatever. There's basically a sort of potential for incredible violence, for a sort of explosion of the violence, but it doesn't quite, it's not quite triggered off, if you like. But the other thing is it's a day which is done without any military intervention, because all the armies are, you know, day and a half, 2 days, more than that, away from the front. And because the army has got to be fighting the rest of Europe, that they don't have a military force within Paris. And in fact, Paris is defended by its own people, by the National Guard. So the National Guard was introduced, in fact, in 1789. Initially, it was only sort of propertied individuals, people of substance, who were allowed to be members of the National Guard. But as the revolution radicalizes in 1792, basically every adult male has a duty to be part of the National Guard. You can get exemption under certain circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, you are, if you're an adult male, you are a member of the National Guard, and you have to do guard duty a few times every month. You, for big occasions, you'll be called in as well. And essentially, what is going on in this sort of face-off between the convention and the City Hall is the attempt to get hold of the people of Paris through the National Guard. They also write to the local administrative sectional, sort of like parish assemblies, if you like, trying to get them mobilized. But actually getting the National Guardsmen, the commanders of the National Guard in each of the 48 sections within Paris on side. Each of them will have a large number of companies, some of which will be on active duty on that day, but all of which, if the tocsin and the drum is sounded, have to turn up and so be prepared for action. They try to get them sort of mobilized. So they're the key, really. And I think the National Guard is something which historians have always tended to neglect looking at the day, because it is essentially the people of Paris through the National Guard who win the day. And they essentially follow the orders. They've been trained, you know, to be great supporters of the revolution. They believe in the right to insurrection, and it's there in the Constitution when the government's going badly. But they don't really think that time has come in some way. So it's a very a loyalist, if you like, movement within the National Guard, which actually makes the day they prevail.
Yeah. Well, First Collins, has been a wonderful interview. My kind of last question here for you is, I'm curious what you think, after all the research you've done and obviously spending a great deal of time in these 24 hours, I'm curious what your thoughts are on how the events that unfolded in this day, what lessons we have to learn in our present day about how all this went down and how Robespierre's downfall came so swiftly.
Yeah, you know, I think we're fine as historians when we're writing about history. We're less good about bringing it up to date or making it real or relevant, if you like, for the present. But I mean, a number of people, when I've spoken about this, this was not something which even occurred to me when I was doing the research, because it happened before it. But the events of 6th of January in the United States were brought to my attention on a number of occasions, because it was people argued that essentially you've got someone in power, in a position of authority, and leader of the executive, obviously, in the United States, claiming to represent through his supporters the people, acting against the existing legislature. So I don't really want to get into that. I don't, you know, comparison between Donald Trump and Robespierre. I don't think we'll get very far, quite honestly. But I think, you know, that there are other striking moments as well. But I think in terms of writing contemporary history, writing about events of the recent past, it is helpful to have this, I think, the type of approach which I've tried out, and to get in, if you like, and not to see everything in terms of structural long-term effects and playing themselves out, if you like, but to see the element of contingency, of chance, of just, you know, anything happening, of serendipity in some ways operating in politics, and in a way, if there's a moral from it, to be always prepared for that.
Yeah. Well, Colin, if people want to stay in touch with your work, are you on social media? How can people stay in touch with what you're writing about and what you're doing?
Well, I hope they would. I'm actually, I've just completed a book, actually, which is edition of a correspondence which a very aged and very counter-revolutionary duchess wrote about the French Revolution from the middle of Paris, moreover, for the most part, in the early part of the 1790s. And I'm just in the process of writing a short history of France, a little condensed history of France from earliest times. If you go on the website at Queen Mary University of London, you'll see what I'm up to a large part.
Oh, that's great. Well, a prolific writer. You've got two more books after this latest one already in the pipeline.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Colin Jones, The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris. Go buy a copy. Go check it out from your library. What an interesting tale that you've told here. Colin. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard. Thank you.